Hi, I'm Christopher Hayes, and I'm the president of Scholar Leaders.
Dr. Christopher Hayes, Christopher, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for being here at the library this weekend.
Well, twist my arm.
Okay, I know it took a lot to get you on that plane from North Carolina to come and visit us, but I'm glad you came.
Very reasonable flight. Feels kind of like coming home, actually. Yeah. I'm an Oxford man, and so walking into the Lanier Theological Library just feels like walking into all the best bits of Oxford libraries all fused together.
I figured you were a Cambridge guy.
Oh, I won't hold that against you.
I hope not. Well, your first time here, your impressions.
It's just been a delight. As I mentioned, it feels kind of like I'm coming home. But at Oxford, it was just a different expression of Christianity on the theology faculty here. Mm-hmm. And so I have the benefit of having the feel of being in Oxford, but I'm hanging out with a whole bunch of my old professors from Wheaton. And so that's just feels like
cool.
The best of both worlds.
Yeah. Well, this is a place that just seems to draw a lot of people to come for our lectures and other things as well. We hope you'll be back.
Well,
for sure.
If you'll have me.
So let's just begin with basics. Who is Christopher Hayes?
Christopher is the husband of Michelle. I'm the father of Judah, Asher, and Zoe, and the begrudging host of a very obnoxious little poodle named Lox.
What kind of poodle? A standard?
No, like a miniature white poodle who has a fetish for stealing socks.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. No. Does she give them back at all?
No, they have to be collected.
They have to be collected.
Yeah, but between the dryer and the poodle, it's just really hard to keep my feet dry.
Yeah. Now, you've done some academic teaching, and that's where I first met you, down in Colombia, Medellin, Colombia.
That's right. Yeah, I was professor of New Testament in Medellin for 8 years, although I actually ended up splitting my time between being kind of a conventional Greek prof and New Testament prof, and also working with victims of forced displacement.
Yeah, and you've written an amazing report about that. On another occasion, I want to come back and talk about that. When we do that, we'll put that in our show notes, and we'll direct people to that. We're going to talk today about scholar leaders, and you've just now recently taken the helm of that organization.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about, I guess, what is the mission of scholar leaders? Let's start with that.
Our mission is to encourage and enable theological leaders from the majority world for the global church.
Now, when you say majority world, I don't know that everybody in the audience is going to get that. What does that mean?
Exactly? Yeah, think Africa, Latin America, Middle East, Asia, the place where the majority of the world's people are, and as it happens, the majority of the world's Christians are. It's a way of reminding us, this language that reminds us, that even though for those of us who live in North America or Western Europe, that feels like the norm, we're actually kind of the minority in terms of the world's population, indeed the world's Christian population. The vast majority of the Christians in the world do not live in the West.
I was in Africa a few months back, and I didn't realize that there are 1.1 billion people on the continent of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned that there are over 330 million Christians in Africa, which is more than the population of the United States of America.
Right.
So more Christians in Africa than there are in the United States, which seems not right. I mean, it seems like it couldn't possibly be right, right?
I mean, it's a fabulous indication of the fertility of the Holy Spirit, right? Because that certainly wouldn't have been the case. That proportion wouldn't have been the case 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's a testament to the success of the modern missions movement. But it also leaves us in this interesting situation today, because you have in the continent of Africa, in Latin America, et cetera, you have these huge burgeoning Christian populations. But you don't have the same substructure of discipleship, of pastoral experience, of seminary education that we do have in the West. And so one of the fundamental beliefs of scholar leaders is that the majority world theological leader is at once the biggest bottleneck in global church development and also the biggest opportunity for leverage for the development of the church around the world.
So tell us a little bit of the history of your organization. You've been president now only a few months or a year?
11 months now.
11 months, okay. Almost a year.
Uh-huh.
you've been president, but it had a history before you got there.
It did.
Tell us a little bit about that history.
It's a pretty beautiful history. I felt really honored getting to know this organization. It was founded in the same year that I was born. It was founded in 1983 by three gents named Tom Cooper, Steve Hayner, and Mark Labberton. Steve Hayner and Mark Labberton were both actually study assistants to John Stott. And they caught Stott's vision for training majority world theological leaders who would then be able to return to their home countries and raise up new generations of theologians and pastors and have this multiplying effect of disseminating healthy biblical doctrine in ways that would foster the growth of the church. It was academia always at the service of the mission of the church. So they started this, basically this giving club. They found some successful entrepreneurial Christian business people in LA and in Chicagoland, and they started to give scholarships to majority world theological leaders. And over the course of the decades, that work grew, and it worked. These people, these extraordinarily talented folks that they brought from around the globe, went home to their own countries, and they became these top leaders, the founding seminaries, training new generations of scholar of pastors and theologians who then were now getting some of the second generation of their students. So all that is extremely cool. But then this observation began to emerge in the aughts, really, that, you know, these people did become leaders of seminaries, and then they found out, gosh, I don't really know how to be the leader of a seminary, right? I mean, you and I, we've, you know, if you got PhDs in New Testament like we do, we learn how to write stuff and teach stuff, and that's really helpful. But we don't learn how to navigate the... you know, the complex labyrinth of finances, of legislation, of accreditation. That's not part of our training.
Yeah, that's right.
Those of us who live in North America, for example, if you become an executive leader of a university, you got this battalion of professionals around you. So they can handle the books and the law and all of that. But if you're at the majority, if you're in the majority world, you don't have that same kind of coterie of leaders. And so scholar leaders said, you know what, we want to keep ensuring the long-term impact of these theologians who have now become executive leaders. So they started doing consultancy work, basically, with these senior leaders, helping them to think through, all right, what's my mission? What's the mission of this seminary? Distinct maybe from the missionaries from 50 years ago that founded this. What's a national mission for the seminary look like? And then how do we build out our faculty, our programs, our libraries? How do we become financially sustainable to achieve that mission? And the cool thing is that even though these executive leaders don't necessarily have the same crew of lawyers and accountants around them that we would have in the U.S., they can lean on friends and scholar leaders, because I've got this amazing team that I work with of a number of leaders who are majority world theologians who used to run universities and seminaries. And so they can come alongside people who are sitting in the same kind of seat that they sat in years before, and they can say, you know what, this is how we're going to help you overcome these challenges and have the impact and the mission that God's called you to.
So would this be a kind of mentoring then that you're describing, mentoring from one generation to the next?
Oftentimes they're going to be the same generation in terms of age-wise. Yeah, yeah.
In terms of experience.
In terms of experience, there's mentoring there, but it's not just informal mentoring. There's a whole battery of technical skill and accompaniment as these leaders from different parts of the world will come together and say, all right, you tell me what your seminary hopes to achieve, and then let's work together on applying the right sorts of tools to help God make that a reality.
Right now, as you sit in the president's seat, what do you think is going to be the next chapter for scholar leaders?
So I've laid out the two pieces that were really important pieces in the previous decades. There were scholarships, and there was working with executive senior leaders. The next piece that we want to add into this is very much around helping majority world theologians tackle the sorts of problems that are too big for any one institution to tackle on its own. And those have a lot of different shapes depending on the part of your world, the world that you're in. But we have a few different project areas, program areas, where we are seeing needs across the majority world, and we're helping these scholars work together to address them. One of these areas is focused on Islam. We're asking the question, how do we help equip the church in the majority world intellectually to respond to Islam, especially in the Muslim majority world.
Where Christians are, may well be in a small majority of the population, a place like Egypt, for example.
Yeah, or, you know, they might be, very often they're a minority. They might experience marginalization. If you're in northern Nigeria, they're going to experience outright persecution. So what does it mean to be a faithful witness to Christ in these different contexts? And we want to recognize that there's not a single answer to this, right? You've got things like West Africa. There is this history of healthy coexistence between Christians and Muslims, and sometimes that's really lovely, and we want to find ways for that to exist as opposed to war. But then you have other places where there's violence and marginalization. And so we want, when we talk about equipping the church intellectually to respond to Islam, we want to eschew any reductionist narratives. We don't really have any time for bellicose polemics or for kind of sloppy relativism. We want to be really clear about the truth of Christian commitments and the truth of the gospel, and also ask, what would it look like to create greater understanding in many ways as a preparation for the gospel? And also, how can we work together when there is understanding on things that are of common benefit to both religious traditions?
So that's going to be the next, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? I mean, it sounds like that's a project
That's a project that's been running for a few years, actually. That's been running for a few years, and you know, there's no reason that we need to cut that one short. But that's actually just one example of what it looks like for us to tackle big problems that are too big for any one institution to tackle. The very newest one that we've just launched into in the course of the past year is a program area that we call Church and Society. But we're asking the question, how do we help the church of the majority world tackle the most pressing issues of their societies? And the first project in this area that we've got is around Ukraine. And there's a pretty extraordinary story to tell there, actually. Before I came to Skol Leaders, I worked with victims of forced displacement in Colombia due to the internal violence that was there. And then as I shifted to Scholar Leaders, I was supposed to start at the very end of February of last year. And I was kind of getting onboarded. And we happened to have a couple of our staff in Eastern Europe working, doing this vital sustainability initiative, this executive consultancy work with Ukrainian and Russian and Moldovan leaders. And one of these staff guys is Ukrainian. And then Russia invaded. And Taras, it's our director of engagement for Eastern Europe, has to rush back into the country, into Ukraine, because he's been called up along with his 5 brothers and his eldest son, Evan. Our vice president, who was also there with him, begins to make his way across Europe by bus and by plane, because the airport in Moldova had gotten closed down. And everybody is scrambling and asking, what's this going to mean? We had been working with these Ukrainian schools, asking the question, how do we help sustain you and foster your growth in the next chapters of your institutions of ministry? And then the Russians sweep in, and in many cases, they take over, you know, they start shelling campuses and buildings. And we asked ourselves, what's the right thing to do in this moment? You know, we can't say we care about your sustainability for the long term, but, you know, come back to us when the war's over.
Yeah, exactly.
This amazing thing happened that Skol Leaders had this fantastic trust already established long before I existed in relation to the organization, such that foundations came to us and they said, hey, is there a way that we can get help to Ukraine? And the Ukrainian theological leaders, the seminary leaders that we were working with, said, we're going to shift the action of our faculty right now as part of our holistic commitment to the gospel to help the people who are suffering violence in our own country. So there's this network of 10 different seminaries that on a dime shift and become refugee rescue centers. Even in certain cases, as their own campuses are taking over, they're relocating to tertiary locations, and they're using their campus vehicles to evacuate people from hot zones. They're feeding people by the tens of thousands. And Skol Leaders was fortunately in a position to be able to foster the extension of resources from the West to these people who are on literal front lines. But we didn't.
That's not something you'd anticipated if you stepped into that position in February of 2022.
It is not something I anticipated. And in many ways, it's not typical of what we have historically done, right? It was a new thing, but it was a moment we felt like God had called us into. But, you know, you ask yourself the question, is this mission drift, right? Because that's not originally what we did. And we asked the question of that out to our Ukrainian friends. How do you feel about your calling, your responsibilities in relation to these immediate needs? And they all said very quickly, look, we've actually got a multi-step plan and a timeline on how we're going to be doing this and how we're going to start, when we're going to start transitioning back to conventional, you know, to offering theological education. And so in August of this past year, with the war still happening, they said, let's start to work together on reconstruction of theological education in Ukraine. And so even
and
as
they're taking that as their own initiative,
we try to be very responsive in this work. So they said, this is the way that we want to start to move. Can you help us? And we said, yeah, you know, that's the kind of thing that we can help. So at these same schools that we were doing this work of focusing on their mission, how to help, how, you know, trying to help them become sustainable for the long haul, we're asking those questions again, but we're asking those questions now in terms of how do you do theological education in wartime? And they are asking all the right theological questions now. They're asking new questions that they didn't have to answer before because it wasn't wartime, but they've lost hundreds of pastors in Ukraine. We've lost dozens of theologians.
When you say lost, that means they've been killed or they've been captured?
It's a combination of flight, of immigration, of joining the war effort, of death. And so there's this enormous need for new Christian leaders. And so these extraordinary Christian theological thinkers and leaders are saying we have to keep training new pastors, but we have to train them to answer new theological questions. And so we're supporting them now as they start to talk about what's it look like to do trauma-informed pastoral care? What's it look like to talk about resiliency and disability in Ukraine when people have PTSD, when people have lost limbs? How do you pastor well there? They're asking questions like, what's the difference between Christian nationalism, the sort of distortion of Christianity, the fusion of Christianity with a nation's agenda that's driving Russia? What's the difference between that and Christian citizenship that we think, as Ukrainians, is inspiring us to resist this incursion from Russia? These are all the right kinds of theological questions, but they're not questions that have extant answers. And we want to be with them and support them as they do this work, because that's what theological leadership looks like. And they're going to define the credibility, not just, I mean, they will determine the survival in many ways of local churches, but they're also going to define the credibility of Christian witness in Ukraine in the coming decades.
Yeah. Man, this is an incredible moment and opportunity for scholar leaders. If people want to know more about scholar leaders, how can they do that?
Well, they should absolutely come to our website, which is scholarleaders.org. That's pretty easy to remember. And you know,
now,
sign up
scholar
for our mailing
singular, but leader plural.
Scholar leaders. Singular, leaders plural, all one word.
Okay. All one word. And you can't do this on a shoestring. You can't do it on a dime. It takes some money. How are you funded?
We are funded by donations from churches, from individuals, from foundations. And if somebody wants to join in with that process,
scholarleaders.org. Well, you have a great mission, and I know you will do a great job as their new president.
God willing and amen.
Yeah. Thanks, Christopher Hayes, for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
My pleasure.
What a great conversation day. I hope you agree. Only 168 hours until the next podcast drops. I can't wait. Subscribe to our podcast. Rate us. It will give other people the opportunity to find us. Tell a friend about us as well. Thanks to the Lanier Foundation, Jocelyn Solis, Phil Keggy, and Kathy Capes, who helped make this podcast possible. Till next time, thanks for listening. Hey, stick around for a nugget of wisdom from Dr. Christopher Hayes.
One of the my favorite sayings in Spanish is, "En tierra de ciegos, el tuerto es rey." In the land of the blind, the one with one eye is king. And I found myself saying it to myself and to my students because it's pretty easy for us to fall into the trap of saying, well, we're not as bad as so-and-so. We do things better than those guys over there. And while that it can be comforting to us, as Christians, we're called to be serving God. We're called to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, and mind, and strength. And that means that just being better than somebody who's really bad isn't really serving God the standard that God deserves to be served at. And so it's a good way to encourage ourselves that when we see deficiencies in ourselves, not to just say, well, I'm less deficient than the next guy, but to remind ourselves that whatever we do, we're going to work at it with all our hearts, is working for the Lord and not for men.